There's a lot going on in Illinois politics. Today, we'll talk about school funding, the Trust Act regarding immigrants and law enforcement, and the fallout over Governor Rauner's shifting responses to an Illinois Policy Institute cartoon most politicians are calling racist. With Congress in recess, we catch up with U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth as she's back in Illinois and hear her reaction to President Trump's speeches this week, especially his military plans for Afghanistan. Plus, what place does religion have in public schools? Two Illinois high school teachers have developed new national guidelines and say this kind of education is now more important than ever.
Our goal is to try and help continue to inform our future citizens and to raise the level of conversation within our democracy so that we can have really important, respectful conversations about what matters most in a lot of people's lives.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The first day of classes is fast approaching for Illinois' K-12 schools. Others will get underway in the next few weeks if they haven't already. The Illinois House and Governor Rauner still haven't agreed on how to fund our public schools. House Speaker Michael Madigan yesterday postponed a vote that was originally going to happen today, perhaps a promising sign that negotiations continue between House Republicans and Democrats. Meanwhile, the state has already missed two payments to school districts so far. Four school superintendents with the education advocacy group Advance Illinois just held a news conference. They're demanding that the state resolve this issue by next Tuesday. I'm joined now by one of those superintendents, Chuck Lane from District 200. He's a superintendent of Centralia High School. They're about an hour and a half east of St. Louis. Superintendent Lane, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Well, thank you for having me.
So tell us, can you explain to us, please, this deadline? You all just said an agreement or an override of Governor Rauner's veto must be reached before next Tuesday. What happens to schools if that deadline isn't met?
Well, the reality for school districts is we've already missed two state aid payments. If we'd have to go past Tuesday, that would be three state aid payments. And this is on top of the fact that many of the schools down south are already so underfunded, they can barely stay open as it is. So we're worried that without more state aid or without this getting solved, some districts might not be able to stay open.
How will your district in particular be affected by the late payments? How far can you all go into the school year without getting any funding from the state?
We could go through September, we perhaps borrow some money to make it maybe through October, but that's it. So, We've already saw our fund balances just get decimated by the years of proration since 2010. So we basically have no reserves. So we're starting off the year in the hole. So our local tax money right now would be the only thing that's getting us through, and that's going to run out sooner or later.
Right, right. Now, are there any areas of negotiation where you especially want lawmakers to have some flexibility on or stand firm? What's most important to you right now?
Well, I think just keeping the core beliefs of Senate Bill 1, you know, we believe Senate Bill 1 is already a compromise. It's been vetted by all kinds of people over the last year, year and a half. It goes all the way back to the Vision 2020 group. So we think we've already compromised to get to Senate Bill 1. But obviously, we've all negotiated contracts before. So we know there's give and take. And as long as some of the key components of Senate Bill 1 are in there, I'm sure it'd be something we'd have to take a look at. But we just have to get something resolved as soon as possible for our school districts.
One of the issues that's been put forward to help get Republicans on board is $75 million towards scholarships for private schools, also a partial tax credit for families who choose private schools. Is that something you agree with?
Well, obviously it'd be hard for a public school superintendent to say he supported private school vouchers. I don't know. You know, we'd have to see the language of all that and how that affected the other things that are in there. I mean, there could be other trigger bills as well. So we probably just have to take a look at it and see exactly what the verbiage is for that. Again, we're not opposed to anything that's fair and that can get us through Senate Bill 1.
But for you, the crucial deadline is how you need to have an agreement. Well, you needed to have an agreement weeks ago.
Yeah. Well, and really Tuesday, we say Tuesday because that would be the 15th day since the Senate sent it over to the House. So once that 15th day passes, then that particular bill will die. Now, they did pass kind of a mirror bill of Senate Bill 1, so they could start talks up again, I guess. But the real problem is you're going to start getting school districts and missing more payments, more state aid payments. And if we get to the point where kids are having to stay home and parents have to stay home with kids and they can't go to work, or high schools are missing football games on Friday nights, there's going to be a lot of pressure on the legislators if we ever get to that.
That's Centralia Principal, Centralia High School Superintendent Chuck Lane with us. Chuck, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
The school funding formula has been yet another contentious debate in the state house, and there's been an added controversy to this. It came when the conservative Illinois Policy Institute published a cartoon many politicians immediately denounced as racist. If you haven't seen it, it depicts a young African-American boy begging on the street for school funds from a large white man who says, "Sorry, kid, I'm out of money." Veteran political journalist from NBC5 Chicago, Marianne Ahern, has been covering this issue from the beginning. She's the person who finally got an answer from Governor Rauner yesterday about this issue, although we got two answers out of Governor Rauner. She's with me here in studio at the Medill School of Journalism, Graduate School of Journalism, downtown Chicago. Marianne, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Of course. Thank you. I'm a grad of Medill.
We both are. So how did this start, Marianne, this issue with this cartoon? And you have been trying to get this has been going on for a little bit of time now. Trying to get an answer out of Governor Rauner.
Absolutely. The cartoon was posted, I guess maybe 10 days ago. And it was during the state fair, I believe, is when we first all noticed it. And the Illinois Policy Institute often has political cartoons on their website. And I don't go to it regularly. However, someone pointed this one out to me. And the day that the Illinois House met last week during the governor's day, to discuss Senate Bill 1. Instead, there was much more passion about the cartoon, and folks from both sides of the aisle felt that it was racist, denounced the cartoon, and stood up and voted against it, had this proclamation saying, how dare they? And, of course, the timing. It happens in the week of Charlottesville, and political cartoons are meant to raise your debate and critique. Excuse me. However, this one really was thought-provoking. Excuse me. Here I am.
That's all right. Here you go. So the cartoon, thought-provoking. Senators, including representatives, including Christian Mitchell, who's been very outspoken about this issue. What in particular did you get from it's been more than a week that you've been tweeting at Governor Rauner, speaking to spokespeople, trying to get a response from him?
All right. So the governor responds by saying, "I haven't seen it." That was what his initial response last week. And lawmakers, maybe a half dozen, stood in front of the IPI building in the South Loop and asked for an apology. And they said, "Hey, this cartoon is racist. We appreciate you took it down, but we'd like an apology." Of course, IPI is not offering an apology and defends the cartoon and says there are lots of folks who liked it and said that it was right on target. The governor continued to not respond and say whether or not he had even seen it and what he thought of it. And it seemed like such an ordinary question. Have you seen the cartoon? What do you think of it? That's all I kept asking. I asked in through the weekend. On Saturday, no response. On Sunday, the response was he's far too busy to watch cartoons, to keep an eye on cartoons.
Right. School funding is the important issue here.
Exactly. And continued to ask until Tuesday, yesterday, this four-paragraph statement arrived in an email. And with the line that said, "The governor, as a white male, does not have anything more to add to the discussion." I just couldn't even believe someone would write that. It was pretty wild to me. It just seemed like a very odd statement to make.
And so I was watching this in real time because you were started tweeting out immediately. And there was one tweet that said the governor as a white male says he can't weigh in on this issue. And then there's a kind of a lot of social media reaction immediately from everyone, including Christian Mitchell, on this issue. And we have sort of hours of all of this reaction from people weighing in.
Hours and hours.
And then
7.5 hours.
And then yesterday evening, according to Politico, the governor was out east settling some of his kids at school, one of his kids at school. And he released another statement last night that said this earlier email was not an accurate representation of his views on this.
And I had followed up with his office after the first email and said, have you rethought what you said? Is that really what you wanted to say? No answer until the second email at 9:40 p.m.
Right.
arrives.
And I will say, lots of journalists around town, I also was reaching out to the office saying, is this a statement? Do you have a statement? This is what you said to Marianne. Are you releasing something? What's going on? Because
right.
now this is in the Washington Post, the New York Times. Everybody's sort of
AP.
Weighing in.
Right.
And what is this? The new statement from Governor Rauner last night says...
It really is as clear as mud. I mean, honestly, the new statement, he will not call it a racist cartoon. And he says there are many passionate people engaged in public policy debates and different people react differently. It is not my place to comment on every cartoon or picture that comes from people outside the governor's office or to tell people how they should feel.
How much of the concern of this and the governor's reaction to this is because that a lot of his new staff has come from the Illinois Policy
Absolutely.
Institute?
Absolutely. That is exactly. Perhaps it wouldn't be such a big deal. There are all kinds of cartoons that some might say, whoa, what's that about? It is exactly because it comes from the Illinois Policy Institute and his new inner staff that he has chosen to be his top communication staff, his chief of staff. All of these folks come from the IPI. Is he not going to weigh in on a cartoon that they've decided to take down, but they still defend?
One thing this all gets to, back to the whole issue of school funding, apart from the governor, is the political fallout aside. The House was supposed to take this issue up today. Speaker Madigan canceled that after a leaders' meeting between Republicans and Democrats. Apart from Governor Rauner, do you think that there's progress being made in the House on this
issue? It certainly sounds that way.
So apart from the governor, it seems like you have a sense that this hopefully will be resolved soon. We were just listening to a superintendent talking about a Tuesday deadline. What's the sense of that?
And especially with these downstate schools that he said he has enough money to maybe get to October.
Which
That's
is what we're
it.
Hearing from a lot of different districts, that maybe they are open or they will open, but they can maybe make it to October. They've missed two payments already. The carrot that we're hearing being offered is that one of the things is that $75 million in private school scholarships. Is that something, I wonder where we have a sense of how many Republicans we need in the House to bring this issue forward.
Right. And then how many Democrats might you lose? Should that be part of the deal? You know, that's the other part of this. And call it what you want. They want to call it a scholarship program. It's vouchers. It's going to be the Illinois voucher program. And it's apparently a five-year pilot program. And, of course, Catholic schools are very big in Chicago and in Aurora and Joliet and places like that. I was with the Aurora superintendent of West Aurora yesterday. He's very concerned about any kind of voucher program because the new Senate Bill 1 is evidence-based. The number of students you have, the number of money you receive. So if students are going to choose to go instead to private schools, that's less money for them. We don't know all of the details of the program yet, but it does appear to be for folks who make less than $100,000. So it's not necessarily giving more money to rich folks who can afford private school anyway. 17 states do have a voucher program. We're certainly not the first. We'd certainly not, you know, the middle of the road either.
And Marianne, but this is the first time this has really come up. I mean, we've been discussing full school funding and the formula, Senator Menar and all his other Senator Berkman, like all of these people have been working all of these issues for years. The voucher issue, this is something that's really been thrown in here at the last minute. I wish everyone could see your face right now because you're looking credulous.
I know. And yet, you know, certainly it's something that private schools have had on the front of their priority list for years, but it's never reached this close to saying this might happen. I talked to the head of the Catholic Conference on Monday, Robert Gilligan, and he said, "Oh, hey, we've been working on this for 2 years, but it's certainly been under the radar, not where we're this close to a vote."
That school funding, one last question I wanted to ask you about. The governor did also announce on Monday he's going to be signing the Trust Act. We've been talking about this quite a bit on the 21st. Last week, we had one of the immigrant groups that worked with law enforcement to write the act on. Can you remind us what this act would do in terms of, so this act would work with law enforcement to basically, the idea is that unless there was a warrant issued for people who were here without legal authorization, they wouldn't be turned over, right? So it would sort of, it clarifies for law enforcement kind of their role in terms of the federal government. Governor Rauner's office did tell you that he does plan to sign this because there's been kind of a back and forth on this as well, correct, Marianne?
Yes, they said he's signing it on Monday. However, he has gotten so much pushback.
That's what I wanted to ask you about.
The pushback since that was released, and articles, of course, quickly followed online as well as front page of the Tribune today. The Sun-Times has something as well. And the Lake County Republican chairman issued a letter, two-page letter last night to him saying, whoa, slow down on this. So, you know, his core, if he has been appealing to his base, which it does appear to be that he's doing the last few weeks, this is a departure from that. And some, one of my sources today say, until he signs that, will I believe it? Because I wonder if he's rethinking it.
Now, we will say this has gotten support from the business community. This is support from different immigrant groups. There's a coalition that's had bipartisan support.
Absolutely.
So just to be clear, there are a lot of people who also support this. He's hearing from a very active member, other active vocal members of the party on this.
And passed with a majority by both houses.
Okay. So that's NBC5 Chicago's Marianne Ahern. Thank you so much, Marianne, for filling us in on all of the things that have been unfolding within the Illinois House and Illinois politics.
It was great to see you.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, opening a new season of art exhibitions with an opening night celebration, Thursday, August 31st at 6 p.m. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When you think of religion in public schools, lots of people might think, ooh, these two don't mesh. But two Illinois teachers have been teaching religion courses at their public schools for years and say there's a huge need for this right now in high school curriculum. John Camardella teaches a world religions class at Prospect High School in Mount Prospect in Chicago's northwest suburbs. And Seth Brady teaches comparative religions, world culture, and sociology at Naperville Central High School in the southwest Chicago suburbs. Both of them were involved in writing up national guidelines that came out earlier this year about how to teach religion in a public school setting. And they're both joining me now. John, Seth, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having
me.
Yeah, Seth, let's start with you. You actually went to Prospect, where John now teaches, and you took a religion class back in high school. What do you remember from that class?
What I remember most is just how much it shifted my own worldview and helped me sort of understand the worldview of others.
And John, that class took a hiatus for several years, right, after that teacher left, but you started it back up 7 years ago. It's a year-long class. What's your approach?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, the class did go away for about 15 years, and I started it back up in 2009, and I teach two separate semesters. So if you take them combined, it's about a 40-week course. You know, and our approach is to take the first semester, and we spend about 3 weeks going through the different founding documents of the United States. We go through the First Amendment and the Establishment Clause. And then we move through most of the major religious traditions of the East. And then the second semester, we spend most of our time dealing with the Abrahamic traditions, as well as a unit on atheism, agnosticism, and humanism to support most of the Supreme Court rulings with regards to how to approach religion in an academic way.
Right, because if you're teaching, if you start with the government, those are sort of starting with our founding documents, obviously you're going to talk about the fact that we don't mix church and state. So how do you describe, first of all, how do you describe this class to people who are skeptical, and also how do you make sure you're satisfying those requirements?
Yeah, so like the big thing that we say right away is that we educate, we don't endorse. And so there's a real distinction between devotional expression of religion and the academic study, or what's known as religious study approach, where we teach about religion. And a lot of people don't think that that word about matters that much, but I would say it's one of the most important words when discussing how you approach religion in an academic way rather than a devotional way. So at no point do we, you know, move into that devotional expression of religion. It is a completely separate way of approaching, you know, the diverse religious landscape of our shared world.
And Seth, I imagine you have pretty strong feelings about why you think it's important that high school students are learning about religion right now.
Yeah, and I'll just echo what John mentioned, that, you know, we really have developed, both of us, a constitutionally appropriate non-devotional course, which I really see, and I'm sure John will agree, has an important civic purpose. It's important not only for students to understand these differing worldviews as an academic exercise, but also with the interest of knowing one's neighbors, both near and far.
John, are you using sort of current events also in your classroom to elaborate more on Seth's point? Is that something that comes up a lot?
It comes up all the time. And, you know, one of the core frameworks we use is the American Academy of Religion, which is the largest group of religious scholars in our country, put out back in 2010, you know, this idea, these three premises, that all religions are internally diverse, that they're culturally embedded, and that they change over time. They're not static. And so we approach each tradition through that lens. And so we try and combat and help people see that religious traditions are not uniform. You know, they are constantly evolving. They're very diverse. And it allows us the ability to try and teach how to approach the religious traditions. And at no point do we come across as experts in any way, shape, or form. It's much more about teaching the students how to approach the study of religion and culture rather than telling them this is, you know, a single monolithic way to approach what is in fact a very, very diverse tradition.
And Seth, I imagine to that John's point, you have a limited amount of time to cover a lot of material. So I wonder how you ensure that students understand the diversity of practices and beliefs that can exist even within individual religions.
Yeah, and I would agree that you know, that approach of really guiding or organizing the class along those three principles is what I do in my class as well, and really try to think about religions in terms of what John and I and our colleagues refer to as the three B's, which is belief, behavior, and belonging, as sort of the core of religious identities. So religions are not only about what people believe, but what they do and how they interact as communities, and sort of the interplay between those three B's. To, you know, think about how that's structured in a course, you know, we start out with sort of the view from maybe 40,000 feet, talking about beliefs and behaviors, and then really try to zero in on, you know, one or two, or as many as we can fit, depending on the unit, individual religious communities, so they get an in-depth sense of really how that community functions and how it relates to sort of that broader view of the tradition kind of written large.
I wonder for both of you, Seth, I wonder if you can start, and John, if you can chime in. What kind of conceptions or questions do your students come in with? Do you find that in particular there are a lot of misconceptions, Seth?
Definitely misconceptions. I would say, though, that really, for the most part, both of our classes are elective courses. So they're interested. They want to know. They realize this is a gap in their learning. And they might not say express it in these terms, but it's really a gap in their sort of citizenship education that, for example, you might have two very good friends who have known each other for multiple years, they're two different religions, but have left it completely untouched and know nothing about that aspect of one another's lives. And this course really gives students an excuse to get to know their neighbors and, in some cases, friends, to really drill down and understand a person's perspective. So it really opens up a space for that. And, you know, I want to add, too, that the framework that was developed to guide teachers in teaching religions isn't just for courses like John and mine, where it's a, you know, standalone dedicated course. It's probably more so for courses like world history or geography or sociology, where there's sort of natural intersection points of the curriculum with religion. And so to equip teachers not only with the framework that helps them understand what is and isn't constitutionally appropriate in terms of teaching, but also provide them with a framework to teach and investigate these religions in a way that's going to be fruitful not only for understanding the religion on its own terms, but shed light on the subject of study. So the culture they're studying, whether it's past or present, or perhaps the literary work they're investigating.
Both of you have mentioned constitutionally appropriate. And John, I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, you and Seth helped write these national guidelines for the National Council for Social Studies. Can you explain, give us a sense, maybe a bird's eye view of what's constitutionally appropriate? I mean, you've mentioned some things, right, that obviously this is an academic setting. You're teaching about religions. What other advice do you have for teachers? What's in these guidelines?
Yeah, so I think the big thing always for me, and this is my personal way of approaching it, is you go back to the Establishment Clause, and we really break it down to really four words, right? There's no establishment of religion. And yet there must be free exercise. And so we really spend quite a few days, and I have the luxury of it because, you know, Seth and I both do, because we teach standalone courses. But any teacher across the state and across the country can help their students become a more informed citizen by understanding that, you know, Seth and I directly are agents of the government. And so thus, because we are agents of the government, we cannot endorse a particular point of view. And so we also use the Supreme Court case Abington versus Shemp. And to put a quick summary on it, it's just that the government cannot, you know, endorse one religion or one religious view over another. And it also cannot, you know, elevate belief over non-belief or vice versa. And so that would be a great place to start. And it's where I start with my students every year about really laying out the rules for how we engage in class and giving them the confidence to begin asking really important questions, you know, critical questions, respectful questions, but questions that do lead them to a deeper understanding of those three premises. And I'll return to again that all religions are internally diverse, that they're situated in the cultures in which they're practiced, and that they're dynamic, that they change. And what we hope to do sometimes, and you had mentioned a little bit ago that, you know, what do students ask? Or, you know, many students come in really well-meaning and with honest questions and honest concerns. And something that we try and help them with is to disrupt some of the assumptions that they might have. And if we're learning anything, you know, and if our lessons and, you know, the materials we use are worthwhile, it will shake things up a little bit. It should disrupt assumptions. You know, we're not there to reinforce what might be a singular worldview. We're here to bring in a diversity of opinions to try and help elevate the conversation.
It sounds like both of you were saying that you almost feel like, in a way, and I would agree with you, that religion is almost, especially with young people, but with everyone really, is a little bit of a taboo. People are either don't want it to the people. Maybe I think a lot of people maybe are embarrassed or they don't know and they don't want to seem ignorant. How much of that do you think is really a gap in civic society right now? As you're saying, in public schools, you really feel like that needs to be overcome.
If I were to just quickly respond to that, is I think what makes people nervous or why it's talked about in different ways that would often be deemed as disrespectful, is that I think a lot of people are lacking the language
with regards to how to engage in these types of conversations. You know, for example, the difference between a devotional assertion and an academic concept, they're two very different things. You know, if you're making a theological assertion about being a practitioner of religion, that's one thing, but to talk about religion from an academic standpoint, that's something else. And so what our courses do and what these new national guidelines we hope do is to give people the language to know how to speak about religion. And when they hear religion spoken about in certain ways, that they know how to compartmentalize it so they understand whether or not it's a devotional theological assertion or if it's an academic discussion about that said tradition or traditions.
Well, and also, as you said, to your point, also people who don't have religious beliefs. That's also part of what you all are discussing as well.
Correct.
So I guess my last question to you is just for both of you, especially at this moment when we're having so much public discussion, I guess in our civic life or in the media about different religions, about the way we're interacting with each other. I wonder for you what advice you have for other teachers out there, other families, parents, people who are interacting with young people about how they should be approaching this. Seth, let's start with you.
You know, I think one of the ways that we got to where we are now, if you look at how the First Amendment is structured with the free exercise and establishment clauses, it really set up a situation where individual traditions and people practiced independently. And it was sort of a, you know, you do what you do, I'll do what I do, or perhaps non-religious added to that as well. And we'll never discuss and we'll never dialogue. We'll just keep it in this essentially a separate space from one another. And I think part of that lack of communication that emerged from that is a contributing factor to what we see now. You know, I think for my advice for teachers, if I had one piece of advice to give, it would be to look up the AAR guidelines for teaching about religion in public schools and to take a look at the new National Council for Social Studies guidelines, because it really does set out very clearly the constitutionality of teaching about religion in public schools, but I think equally important, provides insight and guidance on exactly how to do that, how to approach it. And I think in reading that, a teacher becomes a much better, has an improved ability to navigate what sometimes is difficult terrain in some of these difficult conversations that intersect with religion.
John, we're almost out of time. I just wonder if you have any final thoughts as well.
Yeah, no, I'll tell just a quick story about how I first came to the understanding of religious literacy. As I remember being at a conference with the Archbishop of South Africa, Desmond Tutu, and he was talking about the real problem of religious illiteracy, where so many people are trying to say that religious traditions are wholly positive or wholly negative, and neither of those are correct. You know, Desmond Tutu gave the analogy that religion is like a knife on a table, that how you use the knife is what gives it its quality. And in that way, how religion is used is the way in which it's going to be perceived. And so to present religious traditions as wholly positive or wholly negative is to do a disservice. And so through these religious studies guidelines and through our work, our goal is to try and help continue to inform our future citizens and to, you know, raise the level of conversation within our democracy so that we can have really important, respectful conversations about what matters most in a lot of people's lives.
That's John Camardella. He teaches world religions at Prospect High School in Mount Prospect in Chicago's northwest suburbs. I want to thank Seth Brady as well. He's in Naperville Central High School in the southwest suburbs of Chicago. Both of them involved in writing these national guidelines that came out earlier this year. We'll have more information about that at our website at 21stshow.org. John, Seth, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was a real thrill.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. On Monday night, President Trump laid out his plans for the war in Afghanistan. There weren't many specifics, but his approach to the country's longest war calls for a limited commitment of additional troops, more focus on targeting terrorists, less on nation building. The president also ramped up pressure on the governments of Pakistan and India to do more to help. We've heard lots of reaction and analysis in the past day, but what do our elected officials from Illinois think of the president's strategy? Senator Tammy Duckworth is a former Black Hawk helicopter pilot with the Army National Guard and served in Iraq. We spoke with her earlier about the plan. Senator, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you. It's good to be back on.
Senator, before we get to President Trump's speech on Monday night, last night the president spoke at a rally in Arizona. He talked about liberating American cities and protecting them by building a wall. He made more than a few comments about the media. He said several times they're taking away, quote, our heritage and our history. I wonder if you saw that speech last night and what your reaction to it is.
Well, I did. But my reaction to it was that it was a pure speech to appeal to his base, which is not where the American people, a majority of American people are. You don't unite the country by tearing us apart. And that's what he did, has been doing consistently from the time he got elected to office to his speech regarding Charlottesville and now last night.
We can talk about that more in a minute, but I want to ask you about his speech on Monday night about Afghanistan. You said yesterday you thought it was a speech that was filled with bluster. It was short on details. It raises far more questions than it answers. What, to your mind, is the most important question you'd like the president to address regarding our military operations in Afghanistan?
Well, first and foremost, he needs to commit to drafting a new authorization for use of military force. This is a document that sets the boundaries for our military. Whether there is a ground campaign, how large is a ground campaign, is there an invasion, is that authorized? All of this needs to be done by Congress. And in fact, we are still operating in our foreign military actions under an AUMF that was passed in 2001. So it is 16 years old and is woefully out of date. I think the president needs to also tell us what the end state is. In any military action, you have a defined end state. Take control of the bridge. And when you have control of the bridge, that's the end state. What is that? He has no end state that he has articulated. That's important. Is it when total democracy is restored to Afghanistan? Is it when, what is it? He needs to define that so that we know what we're working towards. Otherwise, you just have this endless action that just keeps on going, and we keep sending America treasure overseas, whether in the form of course, our most important treasure, our men and women in uniform.
Yes,
but
Senator,
also, we're talking about tens and hundreds of billions of dollars already.
Right. So just to be clear, he said he didn't want to commit a time frame, but you're saying it's not the time frame. You'd like to see goals for what needs to be achieved before
exactly.
the operation ends. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
I understand the time frame issue. As a former military officer myself, I get it. You don't want to tell the bad guys, hey, I'm going to be leaving on, October 1st of 2019, because then they just hide out and wait for you. But you don't have to do that. What you do need to do, however, as the commander in chief, is define what your mission is to your troops and what are they supposed to achieve. And if you know what that goal is, then you can work towards it. And as a member of Congress who's going to be controlling the purse strings, I want to know what is his eventual goal in Afghanistan and what do the conditions look like there.
Senator, the president did say during his speech, quote, our nation must seek an honorable and enduring outcome worthy of the tremendous sacrifices that have been made, especially the sacrifices of lives. As you've said, you've just talked about this. You're a veteran yourself. What do you think would constitute an honorable and enduring outcome in Afghanistan?
Well, let me just make one thing clear. All of our troops serve with distinction and honor. So let's not tie the quality of service of men and women in uniform to the on-the-ground realities of what happens in places like Afghanistan, because so much happens there that are beyond the control of our troops, that are even beyond the control of the United States. Foreign actors like Russia, like Iran, who are stoking other terrorist groups that are supporting other forces can come into play. So I reject his attempt to tie the honor of men and women who served and their sacrifice to his inability to act as a commander-in-chief and define what the goals and the parameters of this military action he's proposing is.
He also said that the U.S. military shouldn't be about nation building. It should be for killing terrorists who harm the United States. And I wondered what your reaction to that was.
Well, the U.S. military isn't about nation building. The State Department does that. And in fact, the Trump budget severely cuts the State Department budget. Heck, he hasn't even nominated an ambassador to India, and he called for more participation from India in resolving the issues in Afghanistan. Well, why don't you start over 7 months into your presidency by nominating an ambassador to India? He keeps saying these things about other hotspots around the world, but then he doesn't follow through with the work that needs to be done by our other power, which is diplomacy. North Korea is a good example. We still don't have an ambassador to South Korea. So he does these blustering talks time and again for his base, but there's no substance behind what he is proposing, because he's not capable of being commander-in-chief of our military.
Let me ask you another military question, somewhat removed from President Trump. We saw the sad news yesterday about the sailors who died in a collision aboard the USS McCain. It's a fourth Navy vessel involved in an accident this year. There were seven other deaths in June. We've seen now, of course, a leadership change announced yesterday evening for the Navy. Are you concerned, though, about how we're operating our battleships in Asian waters?
I am concerned about how we're operating our entire military across the globe with sequestration that was put into place back when I first started in the House of Representatives, so before I got there, but, it started in 2012, 2013. Our military has not been funded in an appropriate way. And I'm not talking about the amount of money, but the type of money. So that money has been put into what I've called slush funds to fund overseas operations. But that money isn't available for them to do things like training, maintaining equipment. Our military right now are flying aircraft that is the oldest it has ever, in terms of an inventory of aircraft that it has ever had. We're operating ships with insufficient training for our men and women in uniform who have to carry out these perilous duties in strange lands and on foreign oceans. And we've not provided them with the resources that they need to maintain the readiness of our force. And that means we have to have a real look at what we're doing with the nation's budget, and we've not done that. And so I, unfortunately, am not surprised that this has happened. I do think that the men and women operate with the best ability with the resources that they have and far beyond what resources that they have. And we are not putting the investments into the maintenance of the equipment, and we're not putting the investments into the maintenance of the skills of our men and women in uniform. So, for example, pilots are flying the minimum number of flight hours to maintain their currency or their skill level in the aircraft, but nothing beyond it. They're flying the minimum that is needed to maintain a basic proficiency, as opposed to having the resources in terms of dollars for the flight hours, but also money for maintaining the equipment in order to maintain them at the very highest operational levels. We're not doing that. And you're starting to see it with accidents that happen with aircraft and ships and equipment that breaks down. This is what happens when you keep our military under sequestration for as long as we have and yet expect them to maintain the operational tempo that we've put them under.
So when you get back from recess, I'm sure that's one of the things that Congress will be addressing. Like many of our Washington delegation, you've been all over the state. And I just want to ask you one last question about this. Has been a rather tumultuous few weeks in our country since you all were recessed. You all had some very dramatic moments involving health care even before the recess. And I wonder, as you're traveling throughout Illinois right now, what are you hearing from people most about what they're concerned about? Is it health care? Is it jobs? Is it the hate crimes or neo-Nazi groups in Charlottesville? Like, what are you hearing in terms of what people are most worried about right now in Illinois?
Well, two things, largely. First and foremost, health care. We still have to increase the health care that's available to people in this country and lower the cost. Those are my two guiding principles. I'll vote for anything as long as it increases health care choice and availability to people, and it lowers the cost. So as long as more people can get health care at a cheaper level, I'm there for them. And some of that can be resolved in a bipartisan way by going after things like pharmaceutical companies that really price gouge consumers and hospitals, and as Mylan did, the taxpayers, they just pled guilty.
Right, and you said yesterday you weren't happy with that settlement, right? That's $465 million with the Justice Department. You serve on the Commerce Committee. What would you or others like to see happen there with Mylan?
It needed to have been a far greater amount of money. This was really for a company that has billions and billions of dollars in profit just from this one drug. This was a slap to the face of the American taxpayers. In fact, what it told me was that the pharmaceutical industry has a friend in the Trump administration with this Justice Department accepting a paltry sum when really it should have been a much larger settlement to not only recoup the money for the American taxpayer, but also be an example to other drug companies that you can't do what they did. You can't price gouge on the backs of kids with allergies and people who are fighting cancer. People are just not going, we're not willing to put up with that. And so that's what I hear about when I travel the state. You know, I'm going down to Carbondale tomorrow, and I'm going to be down to Des Moines the day after. And that's what people worry about, is that I can't afford my medications anymore. And what are we going to do to fix that? And there's a bipartisan solution to that.
Senator Tammy Duckworth, home here during the recess, thank you for taking the time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
To get a response also to President Trump in Afghanistan, we reached out to the only member of the Illinois congressional delegation who's also an active member of the military, Congressman Adam Kinzinger. Kinzinger is a Republican who represents Illinois' 16th district, which is as far north as Rockford, as far south as Gibson City. His staff didn't respond to our request to have him come on, but in a statement, he applauded President Trump's announcement we would keep troops in Afghanistan. And he said to hastily withdraw would be, quote, a disservice to the lives lost and would leave a power vacuum for enemies and other terrorist groups like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda to fill. We need to help Afghan special forces prevent their homeland from becoming a safe haven for terrorists and help them achieve a future of peace, stability, and security. Kinzinger served in the Air Force both in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's still a pilot in the Air National Guard. He added yesterday that America, as a global power, must lead these efforts out front in order to stabilize the Middle East. We can't give up. We can't give in. Quote, the future of Afghanistan matters to the future of America's national security. We also reached out to Republican Congressman John Shimkus, a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel who represents our 15th district, to hear his thoughts, but he wasn't available to join us this morning. It's been more than 2 months since 26-year-old Yingying Zhang went missing. She's a visiting scholar at the University of Illinois who was kidnapped on June 9th. The FBI presumes her dead. Former U of I graduate student Brent Christensen has been arrested and charged with her kidnapping. But Zhang's family has not given up hope of finding her. In a news conference yesterday, their first time speaking to the media publicly, the family read a letter asking President Trump to direct all available federal investigators to help find her. Here's Zhang's boyfriend, Xiaolin Ho, speaking with reporters yesterday.
At the beginning, when we said we never give up, maybe you don't believe us. But now, after the struggle of more than 2 months, I'm here and proud to tell you again, we will not give up until we find her. I have ever promised Yin that I will protect her and I will stay with her. Now, I miss the first one, but I will never miss the second one.
Both Zhang's parents and brother are living here and say they won't go back to China without her. Before Christensen was arrested, the FBI declared finding Zhang a top priority. They're offering a $10,000 reward for information leading to the location. The family has set up a GoFundMe page to help with expenses related to their stay. We're going to tweet out more information. And if you follow us at 21ST Show, we'll have it there. We'll also have it at our website, 21stshow.org. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we continue our back-to-school week with a conversation about vaccines with Dr. Nirav Shah, Director of Illinois Department of Public Health. But that's all the time we have for today. Tune in tomorrow for that conversation. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, broadcasting today from Medill Schools of Graduate Journalism in downtown Chicago. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.